Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the VFX Show. Coming to you from the tech compound here in Sydney, but joined by, as I am by my resident experts. Mark Christensen, how are you, sir?
I'm doing quite well, Mike. Thank you.
Good. And Matt Walden, how are you, sir?
Terrible. Not very good at all, really.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, because after this week's film, I have to say I'm going to have to go back on something I said a couple weeks ago. But other than that, it's okay.
Okay. Well, I'll find out what that is in 1 second. So we're here to help prequel Planet of the Apes with Rise of the Planet of the Apes, a wetter VFX fest, if there ever was one, when evolution becomes revolution. This is the film that sets the tale right up until we go into the black hole of Charlton Heston's character being lost in space. And I have to say right out of the gate, guys, I am such an idiot that when I was watching this film, I was so interested in the apes that I started wondering, why do they keep on showing shots of this moon launch thing going on in the background? And what's that got to do with anything? And then like about three quarters of the film went, oh, duh, it's Charlton Heston. Okay, I get it. So, Matt, starting with you, what do you think of the film?
I really liked it a lot. I thought it was something that... I think the apes really make the film. I mean, they are the stars of the movie. The human actors leave a little something to be desired, but I thought they did some really cool stuff with them, you know, making a prequel and creating a script that, in essence, you know, really sets up the whole franchise of the for the Planet of the Apes. And it's kind of a really Frankenstein-esque story. So it follows a really pretty classic formula that I think works really great. So, yeah, I was surprised. I saw it while we were at SeaGraph. I went one night over to the theater and checked it out, and I was really, really impressed. I liked it a lot.
I'd have to say I think it was more successful as a film than the remake of Planet of the Apes that was done a couple of years ago.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, but I will say also that I was fairly surprised at how much I liked it, because when I saw the trailer, I was like, well, haven't I just seen the entire film now? You've just given away the entire plot.
Right.
They didn't really hold much back. So I was thinking it as more of a B film because of that, that it was sort of, you know, all the good stuff's in the trailer. But actually, I agree with you. I thought it was much better than I thought. But maybe that's low expectations. Mark, did you walk in with high or low expectations?
I walked in with no expectations, or at least I tried to. And I really did not enjoy this film very much. I didn't like it. I found the story to be pretty predictable. And it bugs me a lot when films skip or gloss over or ignore details. And I thought this one just... that's where it really lost me. I couldn't totally just kind of relax and suspend my disbelief. I kept getting kind of pulled out of the movie, and I didn't get that engrossed in the characters of the story.
What kind of details in particular, like things that...
Well, I mean, for one thing, there's a... just on the story side, there's a particular type of arrogance that scientists have. And having grown up around research scientists my whole life, I'm pretty familiar with it. And these guys had much more of a kind of a Hollywood bluster, where I would associate it more with, like, if they were doing, if the type of science they did was researching for Revlon cosmetics and, you know, killing a lot of rabbits or something. So I really didn't buy them at all as scientists. I didn't get the motivations. I didn't care at all for the setup of the story. It felt very cynical to me. I mean, the original Planet of the Apes to me is this perfect melding of a Star Trek episode and the Twilight Zone. And just like those, you never get back to that because it's such a period piece. And I'm not really that interested in setting up the whole story again, to be honest. And it felt very much like a studio looking for a vehicle to get another few films.
I think that's interesting that you say that, in that, like, I definitely think they are going to go for, like, a trilogy of movies from what I've been reading here. But I thought it was interesting... the choice of casting James Franco, who seems like he is the guy that you just can't seem to escape. Like, he's like the ADD nightmare, you know, actor, artist, host. You know, he's basically in everything. He's on everything. And I think he maybe wasn't really the greatest choice to sort of be the human heavy, to carry the human side of the story. And I also thought one thing that in looking over the notes, I was like, God, you know, who directed this movie? And I wasn't really sure. And it's this guy, Rupert Wyatt. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of him before. I'd never heard of him. And I looked up his list of credits, and it's a very short list. It seems like he hasn't really been, making films, at least for very long. And I thought it was interesting that they would choose someone, that the studio would choose someone like him to helm a project like this. That, you know, it almost seems like, you know, what kind of movie was this going to be? Like, what is really the goal of this kind of film? And I thought it was an interesting choice to pick kind of a sort of, at least to me, a pretty unknown director, as well as kind of a not really an A-list human actor as well. I thought that those were interesting choices.
Yeah, I mean, Rupert Wyatt obviously had that film at Sundance a few years ago. What was it called? The
Escapist?
Yeah. But the thing is, that's not uncommon. Like, if you look at who a studio tends to get to do a tentpole film where the visual effects are really strong and it's going to be a studio film, not a director's personal vision, right, they nearly always go for a younger, up-and-coming director because, A, they're cheap, B, they're directable, and C, they don't have clout to outgun the studio and cause problems. And so almost to a T, you'll find that kind of a director being offered this kind of a film.
Well, and it's such a different choice to make the film in the way that they made this film, as opposed to the previous sort of reimagining of the franchise, the Tim Burton version, which, you know, I think certainly has its, I'm sure it has its fans, but it also has its detractors. And they did something totally different with this movie, where the visual effects really are, you know, the star of the film. And they went for doing the whole thing. All the apes this time are all done essentially with performance capture, as opposed to guys in suits. And it adds a whole another air of believability.
But I think this is the era. We've now entered the decade, the era where you have films that are, like, you say a Tim Burton, but you could also just say a Tim Burton film, because Tim Burton can open a film, right? It was Tim Burton, a Tim Burton film. Alice in Wonderland was a Tim Burton film. You'll argue that this or that film is a J.J. Abrams film or a Spielberg film. And then you've got the 2012's Planet of the Apes, big effects, tentpole films, which are no longer director vehicle films. You never refer to those films by their director's names. And you've now got two classes of film. You've got a film that's almost directed by the studio, which, for good or bad, I think is where this film falls. And then you've got the film that's directed by the director, where he is the primary creative force, and they're kind of shopping it to the studio.
Do you think you could say, could you say this is a Weta film? I mean, almost in some way?
I was going to say, that's what I was going to say, yeah. And I was going to say exactly that. I would take that further and say, you know, for me personally, this is a Joe Lotero film. This is just like a Weta film.
I thought you were going to say Andy Serkis film.
I don't, because Andy Serkis, though, is heavily profiled. He's actually second unit directing on Hobbit, and I think Andy Serkis will soon become a director who can direct a film and have it as their film, that it'll be an Andy Serkis film. I think he's actually on that trajectory to get there.
I meant it more like you would call it a Meryl Streep film if she'd been in it.
Right, right.
Yeah, like as a star vehicle kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, though I don't know how far I'd push that, because I don't get this sense, and I just don't know how super technically focused Andy is into the ape rendering stuff, obviously driving the motion capture. But I don't think, unlike in Hobbit, where he's actually, you know, literally a second unit director as well as a performer, I don't know Andy's role in this film extended into, you know, how the apes came together and how they looked, whereas Joe clearly was in that role.
No, to be clear, I just mean as an actor, like as acting talent, and getting to really show off what he does best.
Yeah, yeah. And is there anyone better at the world than doing motion capture apes than Andy Serkis? The answer is probably resounding no.
Can I just throw something out there, though? I got to say, and you guys are probably going to slag me for saying this, but watching some of the sort of press materials around the film where they go into, like, you know, really getting involved with Andy Serkis and him talking about, you know, the performance of the ape and stuff. And I know there's, like, a real, you know, craft and stuff to that. But part of me kind of can't help but watch that and feel like it's watching, you know, like a Saturday Night Live skit about an actor who does motion capture. Like, I could see, like, the Will Ferrell movie of, like, a guy who's like a famous motion capture actor, you know, like they did a goofy kind of spoof thing once on Foley artists, you know, where they like made them out to be these really super crazy wacko types and stuff. And not that I'm saying that's the case with Andy Serkis, but there's something about that, that like it's really, I think it's really cool what they're doing. And I definitely think he's bringing something to it, but there's a part of watching that press stuff that it seems, I know there's something a little goofy about it to me.
I would agree. I also think that for the popular press, it's just an easy angle because it's very hard to do a story on the guy that did the eyes shaders and the eye modeling. That's not a story that you get good B-roll on. That's not
a
story that
he's probably a more compelling interview and he can talk about, like, you know,
it's an actual
chimp
person
behavior
in front of a microphone.
No,
yeah.
You're right.
And that's. And so I feel like if you had to market somebody representing Weta, then Andy's the guy because
he's a great guy to choose.
He's a natural. Yeah, it's like being able to interview the apes. Mm. And you know, I put that in the same vein as I saw an interview last night over Cowboys and Aliens, which basically consisted of the interviewer asking each of the actors what it was like to work with the other actors, which I just thought was just, you know, I mean, really, that's the best you can come up with. You got Harrison Ford, and the best you can ask is how was the other actor to work with. I mean,
yeah,
but that's, you know, that's popular stuff. But
press,
I will say this, though, that's probably carrying on the tailwind of what is the fact that Weta has done such an outstanding job that without the quality of the artistry of the individuals involved from the team at Weta, this film would be a disaster and a flop and useless. And that if you want to try and get a face for Weta, then Andy Serkis seems like an obvious choice to the popular press. But they are picking up on the fact that at the end of the day, James Franco doesn't make this film. I think John Lithgow is good in this film, but he's not the one that makes this film. It's the quality of the guys that did the eyes on the bloody apes at Weta in Wellington.
Yeah.
You know, they're the dudes. They delivered. And if his eyes, if Caesar's eyes didn't look like he was thinking, because he had to face it, he doesn't have any lines of dialogue, you just don't have a film.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think, too, the technical feat of, you know, being able to go, and I guess there's something like 1,000 shots in the whole movie. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is an all Weta show, right? I don't know if there might have been one or two other bits and pieces here or there. But, I mean, it's really rare these days to see a tentpole film that is done almost exclusively in one visual effects shop. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does happen, but it's rare. Mark, I mean, do you want to just comment on what you thought of the visual effects? I mean, you commented on the film, but I mean, overall, just an impression of the visual effects.
Yeah, my comment about the details does extend to the visual effects, and I don't hold Weta. I don't hold it against anybody working there. I think it may have been an overreach of scope. And it was the same problem, to be honest, that I had with Avatar, where the hero shots are awesome and the detail is incredible. The close-ups are, you know, really great. And I think it's worth mentioning, too, I didn't jump in, but the Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton one, was actually a full decade ago. And, you know, so King Kong was even 4 years later than that. Tim Burton at that time was doing really pretty campy movies, and it was a sensible approach to stick people in ape suits and, you know, do a Tim Burton movie at that time. And I think even in King Kong era, you know, you can see how far we've come just by comparing Simeon to Simeon and what they were able to do. Not only, you know, with some of the really show-off shots like pulling a camera right out of a pupil of an eye, but also, you know, some of the characters I really liked, the orangutans.
I thought the orangutan was spectacular.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Dr. Zaius.
I actually said I sat in the actual cinema and remember mentally going, "Oh my god!" Remind myself that orangutan is digital, because I was thinking, of course, that Caesar was digital because he was doing things that a non-ape could do. But man, hey, by the way, sorry to interrupt you there 1 second, but I just before I forget, I was remiss in saying that Weta did 100% of it. It did like most of it, but I think Soho and Atomic Arts did some stuff, and also. Obviously, the previs was done by PLF.
Right.
Just before you move off, because I don't want to get dish those guys who obviously worked hard. But obviously, Weta did the ape. Sorry, Mark, I interrupted you. Go on.
No, it's fine. I just couldn't quite totally relax, particularly in the sequences that had apes interacting with humans in human environments. And again, I think sometimes, you know, some of the stuff that was thrown in there I thought was kind of silly and exposed. I don't know. I don't know why you need 50 apes jumping out of the windows of a building, you know, smashing through the windows of the building. Like, that just seemed, some of the stuff seemed really silly. Some of it, I thought, exposed one problem that I saw with the animation, which was that there wasn't much secondary work done when they shot this. So even though I don't think you can even fault the animators for what was going on environmentally sometimes, but you know, if a chimpanzee lands on a table from three stories up, that thing's going to collapse. And there were a bunch of things like that where the weight was missing, down to even having a chimpanzee drag a gorilla along the ground. Right now, you can't blame an animator who's asked to do that shot, but it just didn't seem, I just didn't buy it. And there was a whole sequence of the film where I felt like I was hanging right out along the kind of, you know, edge of the uncanny valley, and I just couldn't relax. The other thing, oddly, that was taking me out, and I don't know if you guys would see this, but motion blur. It, for some reason, This sort of medium to wide shots, I'm not gonna say that they were doing any worse motion blur than anyone else would do. I just somehow in this movie it was really bugging me. Like every time there was a really fast motion shot, of which there were a lot for a while, and we weren't either super close up, or you know. Later, I will say, once we went into the all ape world, then I actually felt like, okay, I can really enjoy this now. Like when it was all of the various species of ape together in their own world, there, I at that point, I was really into it and I was buying it. So I would take that as a big credit for Weta, because that's where they didn't use any animatronics, they didn't use any live apes at all. You know, so at that point, I was totally happy. And this was me watching this, not trying to really dissect it or put on my critical hat, but just kind of, you know, trying to actually stay with the film and maintain disbelief. And that's kind of what happened for me.
Yeah, I'm kind of not with you on some of that. I actually think that the apes over the vehicles and the attack on the top of the Golden Gate, you know what I'm talking about, where they put the blockade up. I thought that was really good integration of live action. In fact, I'll go further and say I thought it was stunningly good integration of live action and computer animation. And it was a very large volume capture space, so they literally did an exterior volume capture space. And we spoke to the guys that were about this. It's in a podcast, FX podcast on FX Guide. So that was interesting. They had a lot of issues like dulling down surfaces and stuff to stop reflections screwing up the motion markers. But then at SIDGRAPH, they did a huge presentation. I don't know if you got across this, Matt, about the fact they were using deep compositing.
Right.
For did you hear that presentation? There was one at the Nuke user group, for example.
No, I wasn't at the Nuke user group meeting, so I missed that bit.
Well, let me just outline this, because this is so new that many of our listeners probably aren't across it, but typically when I'm doing a 3D render, I would produce a Z pass. So you could think of that as having a value. So let's say I have a chair. I'll be really simple about this now. And it's a big wide shot, and the chair is pretty small. And so I'm just going to imagine for a second that the chair is one pixel, but it isn't. But let's imagine it is. Then I would have a value. Like, you know, how far back is that in Z space? And I would actually get that value because I'd get a gray image, which was between black and white, and the gray would tell me that it's, you know, halfway between gray and white. So I'd know it's halfway between the front and the back of my Z depth path. Done. That's it. I have this gray version of the world. Anything close to camera is kind of white. Everything off in the distance is black, and it looks kind of ghosty, but interpreted by the computer, it'll tell you that the chair is halfway back. So if I start doing, I don't know, blurring or something or whatever based on depth, then it's going to blur the chair half as much as it would blur something further back in the scene and wouldn't blur something in the foreground at all. Classic Z depth. What happened about the time of, I think the first case of it was Weta doing it on the day the Earth stood still. You know that shot, guys, where the truck gets eaten by the swarm of flying things? You know, it's a traveling shot. The truck gets eaten as it's moving along. It's in the trailer. It was, do you remember that shot from the day the Earth stood still? It was like the classic shot. There was no actors in it, but the truck's driving. This swarm is coming behind it. It sort of disintegrates. It disintegrates the sign and keeps moving. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So in that shot, that was the first time Weta used deep compositing. It's also was used on over at Animal Logic on Owls of the Galhul, and I was going to be used in the Dr. D pipeline, though that got suspended. And so it's probably being used elsewhere, but it's a very hot topic at SIGGRAPH this year. So then they now render the same thing with the chair that I was describing before, but they actually give you a whole lot of Z information. So it's not just one value for the chair. It's now, if there was that swarm of whatever, it could be smoke, it could be whatever, and we draw a line between my eye and that chair and the back wall that the chair is in front of, I get a series of values all the way down that line for every pixel. So instead of having one value where the chair is, I get a value for a cloud where if you put something in the cloud close to camera, it would have one color and one depth value. And if you put something in the cloud further away from camera, it would have a completely different value. And so instead of the cloud being one or a swarm or a piece of smoke or fire, whatever, being one video layer, as it were, one film layer, that just has one number for where it sits in Z depth, through the image you could move that one layer has multiple levels. So it vastly increases the file size, but it just means that the motion blur, which swings me back around to where you started, Mark, should be mathematically much better because you can actually now correctly motion blur stuff because you actually have samples for things to interact over time, spatially and temporally. Much better. And you can put stuff in fog much better. You can put stuff in clouds and smoke and stuff. And that stuff was all required for what was going on that ape attack on the bridge. Was that really a sequence that you had problem with motion blur on?
No, actually. I was having problems a lot earlier, and it was all on fur. That sequence was great. And in fact, I have to throw in that, I mean, I'm sure we'll, I don't know if we'll go sequentially through this film, but since we've jumped all the way to that, the helicopter crash is so good. Really, the actual shot of it going in the water, I thought was really good. But the whole helicopter crash,
it was good, wasn't it? And there's a great sliding shot before it, where it's like a camera tracking across from left to right, and you're seeing over the tops of cars, and there's this sort of sliding across the bridge, flaming kind of mess of stuff. It's there are apes in there, and the foreground out of focus. It's just so well done. And that's where they used all this new compositing, which, by the way, is now just been released at SIGGRAPH into RenderMan and will, in the next version of Nuke, 6.3 version 3, I believe, go into... Oh, no, hang on. No, that's... But anyway, the next version of Nuke is when Nuke is going to be picking up the deep compositing stuff as well. So it's theoretically going to change the nature of compositing quite dramatically. Makes the pipes a lot complicated. And also, unlike sim data, where you would do a huge sim, create a lot of data, get some water out of it, and then just the water moves forward and you can put all the other stuff in the archive and forget about it.
Seems like, though, it'll hugely reduce like re-rendering times for certain things too, though. Yeah, I mean, if you've got multiple depth samples,
but all that data is going to move along with the file because you're going to need that at the end. Like, you come to revise a shot, like they were doing shots really close to the end on this film, and they could do them because they didn't have to do complicated roto and they didn't have to do multiple passes.
Right.
Because you imagine if you've got a character in fire, you have to render the fire behind the character, around the character, and in front of the character as three completely separate passes.
Right, right.
Whereas if you have one render of fire and then you put the character in and the director says, I want to move him a bit, you don't have to re-render everything. You just go, yeah, no problem, I'll just adjust him.
Yeah.
It's like the math solves it for you.
Yeah, it's awesome.
One thing I was wondering about that end sequence, the lighting of it seemed surprisingly mild to me, and this could be a problem I have. Another set of problems I had with the movie was how much it kind of blew the location of my hometown of San Francisco. It didn't even feel like we were in San Francisco until about two-thirds of the way through it, and I mean, some shots were obviously Vancouver, and granted, your average viewer in Prague or Beijing would not have the problems that I had with it. Or Sydney. Well, though you're spending a fair amount of time over here, Mike. I would expect you to start nitpicking, too. But the quality of light out on the bridge, you know, I've been out there on those days where it's kind of half sunny, half foggy, and the fog just kind of hangs around the level of the bridge. And I thought it was cool that they went with that. But what happens on those days is when the light gets through the fog, it's really bright. Like, the quality of it is hard and bright. And it was, in that sequence, it was really diffuse. And I would assume it was just, you know, somebody's choice somewhere up the line. But I think that the process you're talking about, Mike, would permit you to, I mean, you wouldn't be limited to lighting that feels kind of like the way you'd light for a more limited dynamic range camera or something like that. Like, you could really push it.
Yeah, what I'm discussing wouldn't change the dynamic range that you're allowed, but it would certainly make it easier because, for example, if you put a plane in clouds and you use even half of what I'm talking about, which is to just say a depth map and not even a color map, so it doesn't carry the color changes, you can look a little bit like it's mixed in, but... And maybe that's a little bit of what you're seeing here, because in this implementation that Weta used, I believe they were only using an optical, like a Z depth with steroids. They weren't doing a simultaneous color map. The new version of RenderMan will do a simultaneous color map. So as you had the bright sunlight at the back of the shot, if a character walked through the shot and was going to be hit by some light at the back of shot, it would work spectacularly well. They could be like come yellower with warmer light hitting them, even though there's a lot of fog between us and them, and there's only a pool of light back 100 yards from where the camera is. I mean, that is exactly what it does really well. And I actually agree with you there. I totally give you that one. I think that didn't feel, it felt studio-esque in its lighting, which I'm really sort of loath to say, because the DOP on this is just one of my all-time favorite heroes, Andrew Lesney. But I would agree. That didn't have that San Francisco kind of sunny, glary, foggy thing that you get. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, that's a really good observation. And in fact, that's an observation I couldn't have articulated. You've really nailed that. Not until you say it does it ring true.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, that sequence overall I would give you was, you know, a tour de force, and I didn't think about it all being mocap until afterward. But the fact that they were daring enough to shoot a bunch of mocap in bright daylight alone must be a first, yeah?
It's one of the largest capture volumes ever, and not being in a studio but being outside. Obviously, there was green screens that weren't obviously on the bridge, but, you know, a section thereof recreated. Yeah, no, I thought it was. I thought that end sequence was technically just spectacularly well done. I do agree with your earlier comment about jumping through the windows. I loved this film. I will say, though, at the edge of my love was, why are all these apes jumping through windows? Because it seemed like gratuitously hazardous. And also, excuse me if I'm wrong here, but didn't they release a bunch of apes from the zoo that didn't get exposed to the neurotoxin/intelligence enhancement? So why would those guys be so quick to take orders from Caesar? But anyway, I digress. But I definitely thought that that was like, yeah, hang on a second. Though that being said, we all know that, I guess we all know, that chimps are phenomenally strong, much stronger than the sort of proportionate same height human. And so, you know, I don't think they were pushing the boundaries of sort of superhuman strength and that the apes could do anything. But, yeah, jumping through the plate glass windows just didn't seem like the sort of thing that you would do. I imagine a chimp throwing something at the window and then jumping through, but they don't seem like they would just take a full-on leap at them simultaneously, multiple windows, multiple floors. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a bit A-team. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were way too beholden to the earlier films. I mean, the number of little nods and winks to
Planet of the Apes. Oh, that was fun. What are you talking about? That was awesome.
But, Mike, now, let's drive a truck through the big hole on the Golden Gate Bridge. You're not going to have mounted police with clubs go after apes who've proven to be dangerous killers and who've taken control of the national monument, the Golden Gate Bridge. They'd be out there with the machine guns right away. There's absolutely... That was just simply because.
Yeah, but didn't we like Bright Eyes as the name for Caesar's mother? Or didn't we like the.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you that one.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape. No, not that anyone's ever delivered that line as well as Charlton Heston did.
So why was there no, you maniacs?
Well, like, what about the apes watching, was it the Ten Commandments on the TV in the in sort of the ape halfway house? So they had Charlton
Heston
as Moses.
But wasn't the last thing that
What's that?
But didn't Charlton Heston fall to his knees when he sees the thing and he screams out, no, and then that was the first thing that was said by Cornelius? Or am I just forget? I just remember when he fell to his knees.
That was
when he
Star Wars Episode 3.
No, when he sees the bloody Statue of Liberty sticking out of the sand.
Best
visual effects shot of the 70s, that one. Yeah. If you were the visual effects shot, that guy that did that thick matte painting of Charlton Heston in front of that Statue of Liberty on the sand, I'm sorry, you should be given an honorary Oscar and taken out to dinner, because that was a cracker.
That's your whole reel, was just that shot. Right?
Oh, my God, I loved that. That when I was a kid, there was just like, I just blew my mind that ending of the original Planet of the Apes. Now, admittedly, I was like 12 or something, but, man, I friggin' loved it. I did not like the subsequent sequel films, but I liked that one. Okay, so I've jumped around. So let's go back and discuss some of the earlier stuff. There was a little bit of a puppet when they were walking around with the baby Caesar, but other than that, you're right, absolutely everything was digital. We've talked about motion blur on the fur. Let's start at the earlier stuff. There were no real primates in this film. Did we not like the early primates, Mark? The early part of the film?
I thought it was great. The other place where I hit the uncanny valley was just when, frankly, I just thought they were being asked to do stuff that was a little too anthropomorphic. And I think part of the reason I really liked the orangutan is he was allowed to just be an orangutan, you know, like a really smart orangutan.
Isn't anthropomorphizing the entire point of the film?
Mike, then I wanted to see them go further with it, because the other problem is they didn't really become Planet of the Apes apes. Like, to me, they only teased you. Again, it's like, okay, three films later, we're going to get, you know, the real deal. And here, you know...
God, you're a cynical man, Mark Christensen. You want machine guns on the thing. I'm just... You live in a world without sunshine.
San Francisco in the summer.
Matt, help me out here.
Well,
film.
Yeah, I mean,
gorgeous.
I would say, you know, that there were a few shots here and there that I found, you know, they were less spectacular than some of the others. I would say, I think, you know, overall, you know, Caesar's performance as well as some of his compatriots, by the middle of the movie, if not before, like, I mean, I was totally hooked in on the story. Like, it totally had me. Like, I took a big bite and I was like on the line, like I was going to follow it the rest of the way through. And I was totally satisfied, completely entertained. And I was incredibly impressed with the number of, apes that they had, you know, full body, fully rendered, all with like, you know, fully dynamic hair. I think, you know, I was at Weta for the very tail end of King Kong, and when I showed up with, you know, maybe, what, like 3 months to go or something on that job, they had yet to do one, my memory is correct here, I think they had yet to do one full frame render of Kong with hair. And so in the last, like, 3 months of that show, they were, like, you know, going through all the full frame, full body shots of Kong, like, and they were working on getting all that stuff dialed in. And now, granted, that was a number of years ago, but that clearly was a huge touchstone film for Weta on this project. And they brought back, a lot of the same guys that had worked on the Kong job in terms of the creature work and the hair management crew and stuff, the hair TDs and whatnot. And I think the kind of stuff that they were able to achieve, the number of creatures and the amount of dynamic fur movement in some of those shots where there were more than, two or three apes was just totally staggering. I mean, it was incredible. And even down to the detail of, you were talking about the orangutan, the sort of, I think it's Dr. Zaius, right, in the future movies, but how they even were dealing with how, like, an orangutan will have... almost like dreadlocks starting to form under the arms where the hair kind of clumps together and it gets real tangled as it gets longer flowing down. And you saw that really having a totally different dynamic than some of the more kind of wispy fur when he's...
I thought the orangutan was faultless. I swear.
Yeah, when you see him swinging like arm over arm underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and seeing the movement and the attention to detail in some of those shots was really just... totally amazing. One of the other things that I was going to say that I sort of had trouble with, and this maybe is closer to what you, some of the things you were saying, Mark, was I actually thought that the when the James Franco character brings home the box with the baby Caesar in it, and they open the box, and there's this sort of hero shot of the baby Caesar, like, okay, yeah, it's cute and all. But there was something about that it really, it looked like it wasn't really, like he wasn't really sitting in the box, and it felt real soft, like the shadows and the lighting on the character as opposed to the live action plate, and it just didn't look right. It looked like he was moving independent of the box that he was lying in and stuff, and I thought that was one of those shots where, to me, it kind of took me out of it, and it did have the kind of uncanny valley of not looking like a real baby chimp, at least in that one shot.
I do have one major kind of could somebody explain it to me moment, which was, and I'll just get past this because I didn't think this film was faultless. I did think it was good, but I don't think this was the best film I've seen all summer. I don't quite understand why the vaccine worked so well on the father and didn't cause him to cough up blood and die when. When given for Alzheimer's, that it obviously didn't work because the dementia returns and he dies, but he doesn't die a gruesome death splitting up blood with a fever, which everybody else seemed to do within seconds of being exposed. Well, not seconds, but days of being exposed to the darn stuff.
And I mean, then you've got this kind of Andromeda Strain type subplot that doesn't really go much anywhere. It takes out a couple of people, but... it doesn't seem to have any traction as far as
I think it does wind up being a huge story point because it's the thing that wipes out credits. The bulk of the human race, right? It's the seed.
If you watch the end credits.
Well, yeah, you have to watch the end credits because that's the whole thing about the pilot next door.
But it's all done with pretty motion graphics.
Well, there's a problem with that?
No, I love pretty motion graphics.
I thought it was great. I thought it was one of those... No, I thought that was terrific. It was just that they let it just play out like that, and your imagination is that you just saw the world consumed.
But it still works better if you're already a fan of the series. Like, otherwise it's like, oh, I see. Okay.
So one question I would have for you guys, and Mike, Mike, you might know more about this than either me or Mark, but when you look at the overall... motion capture of whether it's Andy Serkis or any of the other actors, but in particular on Caesar, and then the facial capture rig, whatever kind of retargeting they have to do to sort of reshape the sort of anatomical differences between the face of a chimp and the face of a human. Do you know how much did they really get off of the facial capture rig, and how much was that like gone back and done by hand in terms of really articulating the performance?
I mean, they got stuff off the facial rigs, but the eyes, you can't, you can sort of track eyes, but you obviously can't stick dots on eyes. And I put a lot of the subtlety in the performances down to the eyes, and mm-hmm. therefore I put a lot of it down to the animators rather than the motion capture.
Yeah,
I think that Andy Serkis gave a lot in terms of, sort of an approaches and the heads and everything else. And I think he's terrific, but I just think that you could easily pass over the huge contribution from the digital animators who actually nailed it, both in terms of the eyes and then just what the eyelids were doing, Because the actual structure of the eyes on a human versus the actual structure of the lids and the stuff on the ape, even to how much, like the orangutans in particular, don't look like, we don't see much white. What's that called?
The sclera.
The sclera of the eye.
And you don't, so you tend to get that black thing because the eyeballs to the size of
the opening. They don't have whites of their eyes, they have blacks of their eyes.
Yeah, and so it's, so there's lots of stuff going on there that that you needed to get from, and also the other thing is, you know, the musculature and stuff, people think that motion capture gives you a huge amount, but if you think about it, it's giving you the surface.
Right.
You actually have to take that and translate that into what the muscles would be doing underneath the skin to cause the skin surface to do what we just got some data on. And then after that, you've got to work out what the bones were doing that were supporting the muscles that moved under the skin that we just got the data on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big fan of motion capture, but it ain't like it's giving you a fully rigged animation, and certainly not dealing with some of the problems, no matter how good it is, that comes from that translation.
I mean, that's,
down.
That's what I thought too. Like, I mean, looking at it, it just seems like there's so much of like a hand... you know, an animator's hand involved in so much of what we're seeing, and it just, not to go down a rat hole or anything, but I have to say, it just is one of these things that it just makes me crazy that, I mean, I don't know if you guys read this thing about, this was a year or two ago now, but the American, the Motion Picture Arts and Sciences group is saying that, you know, motion capture is not an animation technique, and that, you know, a film like this couldn't be considered for any sort of animation award from the Academy of Motion Pictures, and I just look at something like that, and I just think, you know, that seems like such a that seems like a really ignorant stance to take. It's making an assumption, you know, about the nature of what it is that's on the screen, and seeming to assume somehow that it's all done, you know, by a machine. That there's no real art or technique or animation involved in what's going on. And I don't know. I look at a film like this, and I think, God, it's a shame that, you know, the fact that I'm able to sit there, or even looking back at Avatar, I think, I mean, for me, Avatar was similar to this in that, you know, I found myself, you know, actually, you know, moved emotionally by, you know, something that wasn't there. And I think that, you know, the ability for that kind of animation, motion, combination of animation and motion capture and, you know, lighting and rendering and all that, you know, coming together to be that powerful and to be that emotive, and then to sort of be kind of disregarded in that way too, at least in that category, seems kind of ridiculous to me.
Oh, I agree. I actually have quite strong disdain for that whole thing because I don't think... But, you know, I mean, by the same token, I've got to get over looking to the Academy to be some kind of arbiter.
No, I mean, it's true, but I mean, but it's like, it's how far are you going to go down that road, right? I mean, it's like, so are we going to go back and, like, take some of Pixar's awards away because they're not all hand animated? In some cases, you know, there's some cloth simulation and some hair simulation in there. So, you know, is that is that no longer animation, you know, because it's done by, in essence, in part by a machine, right? I mean, I don't know, it just seems ridiculous to me. It's sad that... that things like that, you know, aren't taken into account. I don't know who makes those decisions, but it seems foolhardy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do agree. I think, as I say, though, that you can give the Academy too much for
clout, yeah,
being the ultimate authority of what is or isn't. And you know, there is a business behind the Academy and stuff. It's not,
sure.
You know...
Yeah, they're selling advertising and stuff like that too, and increasing ticket sales and whatnot. So,
okay, but let me ask you guys in a kind of bigger, broader brushstroke. Then we discuss a few shots, not maybe as much as we normally do, but I've been enjoying the conversation. But how does this film rate to Transformers and Harry Potter 7 Part 2?
Well, you know, at the beginning when I said that I was not doing so well, I mean, I still have yet to see Harry Potter. Forgive me, I haven't had a chance to get out and see it, but. But I, after walking out at the end of this film, seeing the whole thing and walking out, not walking out in the middle, this was no Scott Pilgrim for me. But at the end of this, at the end of this film, I really felt like, God, you know, if it were up to me, I don't know. I don't know where I would fall between this. I had said earlier that I thought Transformers 3, from a visual effects standpoint, was really the film to beat. you know, for the, you know, at the VES Awards or at the Oscars or whatever this year, because I just thought it was so incredible. But I also think, in a different way, the effects work in this film, you know, Dan Lemon and Joe Letteri, heading up the team at Weta, I think the work that these guys did and the overall impact of that work on screen is so powerful. I think it's in the zone with that stuff for me. I mean, it's a totally different kind of film. I think it's a very different kind of visual effect in that we're dealing with an organic shape as opposed to, you know, machines and huge effects simulations and stuff like that in Transformers. But I do feel like it's in the same league without a doubt.
Yeah, the middle of this film won me over to that concept that I was seeing something here that really is breaking new ground to populate the whole environment of the animal control. It wasn't even called care and control. It was just called the animal control facility with all these poor, hapless simians, and so many of them, and doing things like being shot with a fire hose and, you know, just amazing stuff.
By Draco Malfoy, I should point out.
Oh, is that who that was? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. Wow, he looks so old now.
Well, that's what happens when you buggerize and, you know, pick the Dark Lord over, you know, Harry, and you have to end up working in a chimp facility for the rest of your life.
Oh, that's so funny.
I'm sorry. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the when you guys were talking about the, you know, the problem that the Academy has, it reminded me of the story of Tron, where they really didn't make their case at all of what they had done on that movie, and they got kicked out of the consideration completely. The VFX Oscar, because
the original
people
Tron
in the VFX field, yeah, the original Tron, people mm-hmm. in the VFX field thought that they had just typed some lines into a code into a computer and done the effects that way.
Yeah, they wish.
So
like that, right?
I think these guys, in addition to those spectacular wide shots of the whole environment of these great creatures, would do well to really show off how they worked with Andy Serkis, because I think you're right. I mean, he had that camera on him. If you look at the behind the scenes footage, but he really didn't look like he was made up for mocap particularly, nor did it look like they were putting him in a setting where they could really rely on it. It seemed like they were taking reference. And
yeah,
if that's the case, then, you know, they've really done something pretty extraordinary here because of how much... I mean, okay, I wish they had done maybe two-thirds as many shots so that there would have been fewer of what felt like these gratuitously big epic shots that kind of took me out of the movie,
but that
the
can
ones
be directorial.
They did. What's that?
That can be directorial. I mean, that can
oh,
be.
Oh, absolutely, you know, just... absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
I think though, if they had taken out more shots, though, they would have then had to rely more heavily on the lead human actors, and I think they weren't, you know, as compelling on screen. I mean, in all sincerity, I don't mean that.
Oh, come
as
on. John Lithgow in that car scene where he bumps the car forward and backwards and then Caesar breaks out. Did that scene not work for you guys at an acting level?
No.
I thought John Lithgow was terrific.
No, he was good. I guess I just mean the reliance on Franco.
You just
and,
got it in for, yeah, since the Oscars. Well, it's okay. He was a crappy Oscar host, but he wasn't that bad.
Well, I just don't know that he's heavy enough to. I think there's several other choices that could have been made for a lead actor, somebody who would actually be, as you said earlier on, Mark, too, somebody that might be a little bit more believable as a scientist, you know. And I just, it's hard to buy Stoner James Franco as a, you know, leading scientist.
Well, and the guy playing his boss was also pretty over the top.
Yeah, I agree.
If we could have a bad guy that wasn't an evil corporation, it'd be good. But
exactly.
Okay. All right. So.
So anyway, I think they've got a great shot at making a strong case for what they did here. Come Oscar time,
Potter, Transformers, better, worse.
Well, those feel
contention?
Bigger, and that's kind of ridiculous because this certainly was no small movie. So.
You know, it's interesting though. Like looking up on the last page of the dossier that Todd Sheldon put together for us. Like it's, you look at the last page, and the overall production budget is less than the, not by a lot, but a little bit less than the overall production
budget of Transformers.
Yeah, no, I was going to say than the overall budget of Cowboys and Aliens. And now, granted, Cowboys and Aliens has a much bigger sort of probably above the line costs that it's incurring. But I think there's probably more effect shots in this movie by at least a factor of two. I think if you've got 1,000 effect shots, I think that's far more than...
Well, now, I should flag the fact that we were pretty pathetic in our coverage of Cowboys and Aliens. There's actually a lot more effect shots in that film than we gave it credit for because they were so good. And not only that, but we're completely pathetic for not picking the miniatures because actually got a lot of miniatures work in that. And I was shamed. I literally, I didn't because I would have been too self-serving, but I nearly pulled that whole show. Oh. Once after I'd done it, I then had a lecture on how much ILM had done on it, and I felt ashamed that I couldn't pick the work that they'd done. I really counted my manhood cheap on that show. I would,
all right,
because
then.
There's actually a lot more visual effects in that film than we gave it credit for, a lot more miniatures work and really clever stuff that was done. And some really neat stuff, actually, that we didn't pick up on, which... it's not that we didn't research it, because quite frankly, to a certain extent, if that stuff isn't out there, you can't possibly know it unless you worked on the film.
Yeah.
And we were judging it on what we saw in the cinema. But it was maybe because we were all exhausted.
Well, and in some ways too, right? Isn't it also sort of high praise, right? I mean, if we didn't know that those were effects too, right? I mean, but you know, yeah. I mean, it's good,
a verbal retraction.
You know, for what was missed.
Yeah. So if you're at ILM, you could take my lameness as a complete compliment. And, but I will say this: I think that somebody raised a really interesting point just then, which is there is a little bit of a risk actually on saying that a film has better effects because it has literally bigger by the form of scale effects. In other words, if you destroy a city, it feels like it's harder work than making an ape pick up a spoon out of someone's hand, put it around the right way, and put it back in their hand again, when that's not necessarily true if you think about it from a, you know, craft point of view.
Well, yeah, I mean, that goes back to the year that Golden Compass won the Oscar. I mean, since we're doing, well, I don't know why we're doing Oscar punditry, but it seems like maybe we just chose to look at it that way because it feels like we've just run through three of the biggest.
Yeah, I think that's exactly why.
Yeah. So, Golden Compass, you know, wasn't a very good film, and yet they did some stuff in there that was kind of unprecedented and Oscar worthy. So, yeah, this could be that.
And also, we're in August now. The Oscars are in Feb, but Oscar season will pick up at the end of the year. So if you're going to get a big blockbuster film out, it's going to be now or pre-Christmas. So there are obviously some big pre-Christmas films coming down the pike. But, yeah, it's a fair bet that in our category of VFX, these films will feature very heavily in the bake-off and probably in the nominations and in the final awards.
When you just look at a lot of
James Franco backlash.
Oh, yeah, hosting the Oscars again.
The Academy will be biased against this film. That one.
Yes. Mm. Anyway, maybe. I don't know who is hosting the Oscars, but yes. I'm certainly not going to defend that particular motion capture performance. Okay, so Weta's done an outstanding job. We had not really discussed in great depth the fur and stuff, so I think we should just do that before we finish up, because it obviously is a huge part of it, the rendering of the fur. And also I would say in a similar vein, there's a huge sequence at the end where Caesar and the apes climb the redwoods, and that had to be a fully digital forest because of the camera move and the interaction with the apes and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of other stuff that again is beyond character animation and beyond motion capture, like the environment rendering and the fur rendering, that are either procedural or sort of classified more away from character animation. And I thought they all held up really well. We discussed that clumping of the hair under the orangutan. Was there any other aspects of the hair or the foliage or the environment stuff that you caught your eye?
It looked great under natural light. You know, these hero shots of Caesar, of which there were a lot, you know, he likes to hang out by a window. And he always looked really good in that setting.
Yeah, and I think you look at all the hair work that's done, and just having worked on some of these kinds of jobs, that there's a group of creature TDs, and maybe even some special hair effects TDs and stuff who are working as part of a small to medium sized team and putting in incredibly long hours trying to train the fur and get it to behave dynamically in the way that seems believable and real. I know. Mike Corcoran was the lead creature TD at Weta, and he was at Weta for Kong. He was at Image Movers Digital, where he was the character effects supervisor on Christmas Carol. But he's back at Weta now, and he was working on that show. He's now on to Tintin. But I know him and his group of guys that he works with, they were, and men and women, I should say, were putting in incredibly long hours towards the end of the show to try to get this job done. And I think, the proof of their hard work is up on the screen. I feel like, what you see, I didn't see anything, with regards to the hair in terms of how it interacted with the light, how it moved with the characters, how it, folded in places when the characters would kind of give into some more extreme movements. Even when you've got Caesar wearing, his best chimp human clothes, I think all that stuff just looked really great. And it's leaps and bounds ahead of where Weta was, a number of years ago on King Kong, even.
I definitely think this was a more successful film than Kong.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
I do too.
But it is, significantly advanced. And I should also point out that deep compositing stuff they used on Avatar. I don't think I got to mention that, but that was used on the forest in Avatar. But nevertheless, if you look at their involvement with Massive, you look at their involvement with decompositing today, you look at their involvement with the work from films like Avatar, but obviously all the Lord of the Rings films and stuff, there's no doubt that Weta got put on the map by Lord of the Rings, but has earned its right to be there on its own. Because, look, there are some films that Weta work on that I don't necessarily care for, or they're just not big-budget films, they're kind of more traditional films. I don't know, Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer or something that, is not like a pivotal film. But they have delivered time and time again. And just unbelievable to me that a company in Wellington, New Zealand can now be so established as, one of the top maybe two or three lead facilities in the world consistently. And it's stunning. I mean, it's brilliant. And this film, I think, would be just nothing without them. It was just, really turned on how well those, in my opinion, how well those eyes said to you, this character is thinking, because there was a lot of non-dialogue acting going on there.
Mike, if you don't mind me doing a tiny bit of cross-promotion for you, I actually just yesterday listened to your FX Guide interview with Dan Lemon, where you guys talked about specifically about the eyes. And one of the great things I thought, and all the stuff about the eyes and about going to, there was an ophthalmologist, I guess he said, he's a friend, there was a friend of Dan mm-hmm. Lemon's that he plays soccer with or something like that. And they went over and he showed him all these different eyes and talked about the different anatomy of the eye and all the really pretty extensive research that they did in gathering all kinds of just real world information of how these things would behave under different light conditions and sort of the meniscus underneath the eye and all the detail that they research. And Dan, is such a cool guy, like the way he put all that information together. And then there was one good question in there too, which you were talking about the other effects that we sort of didn't talk about specifically. You did talk about the fingers and the hands of Caesar and some of the other apes and how the kind of leathery skin and how that look really comes across as something. It looks practical when you see it on screen, and I thought that was really astute. That was something that I thought as well watching the movie, that it's something that looks so it looks so hyper real. And that with even the Foley sound, where when you hear the sort of leathery fingers touching another surface and stuff, the sound that it would make really helped sell the look of that too. And I thought all that stuff was just incredibly successful in those extreme close-ups, the level of detail that they were able to achieve.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, I really enjoyed that interview. Obviously, we try to make this a review show and that literally an interview show. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Dan was in New York actually for the premiere with his family, and Dan was generous enough to actually talk to me one evening, because you know it's really hard with the time zones, while he was effectively on holidays having finished the film. So
yeah,
I really appreciate it. And if you want to check that out, that's part of our FX podcast series, which is on FX Guide. It's called Rise of Planet of the Apes, The Eyes Have It. I unashamedly, selfishly focused on the eyes a bit because I think they were just so terrific.
It was a great interview. Lots of really good information in that one.
Yeah, it's great when we get to talk to these guys at some depth for some amount of time. I mean, this show, I think, is terrific because we can be, you know, blunt in our own personal opinions, but at the end of the day, we're looking at it from outsiders, albeit them informed experts. But, you know, it's another thing completely to hear firsthand. And I've got to say, in the case of things like this and also, as I said, Cowboys and Aliens, there is stuff that you just don't realize. And I guess if you were quizzed, you could probably work it out, but you just sort of doesn't occur to you until you go, oh, yeah, of course, they had to do that. Mm-hmm. There's no way that wouldn't have been the case. And but, yeah, for me, the eyes and in particular the orangutan, which I just still can't get over just how great that was. It was just brilliant. I mean, let's do a remake of Every Which Way But Loose is what all I can say.
Oh, no. With a digital Clint Eastwood. Mark,
oh,
there you
now,
go.
Now you're being cruel.
Now the Academy is going to have a fit.
Mark, where can people track you down if they want to?
Let's go with Flow Seeker on Twitter. See you
brilliant.
Out there.
And Matt, it was great seeing you in Vancouver.
Yeah, great fun seeing all you guys in person. It was fun. You
it was
can always
good, though I was completely trashed that day, I must admit.
You and me
exhausted.
Both. But yeah, you guys can always find me on Twitter at Matt Wallen or at mattwallen.com.
And of course, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter, though you'll find me at FX Guide. I should point out that that FX podcast that we mentioned a moment ago is we don't do the FX podcast by numbers, but I'll just do a little bit of a peep behind the kimono. That's actually the 195th FX podcast we've done since the 5 years we started doing them. Wow. We do them at a rate of one every 2 weeks thereabouts. And so, yeah, so we're coming up on the 200th episode of in-depth discussion with people in the industry. So if you aren't a listener, but you listen to this show, you might want to check out the FX podcast. A lot of people find it to be really good. All right, well, thanks so much for this. It's been a madhouse, but I'm going to get out of here. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.